Sir Brooks Richards, Reel 11.
Because of vicissitudes of this kind, we, for example, on our way back from London, when it was really quite urgent to get us back to Algiers to give effect to things that had been agreed, I remember I had time to read the whole of War and Peace between leaving London and getting to Algiers. We had successive false starts in places like Brize Norton and St. Evil, and in London, our consultations went very well, and by the time we got back to Algiers, really, Wiedmer had become something rather more central than the DGSS training officer. He was really the man who knew more about the communications layout as seen from the London end than anybody on the French side in Algiers. And he naturally acquired additional clout and responsibilities from this. And the next stage was that we had to set ourselves up as a joint Anglo-American headquarters to deal with these problems together with the French, so that I found myself becoming head of an integrated, well, joint head of an integrated section, my oddest number being a delightful American called Jerry de Purlanc. Well, now, Jerry de Purlanc, despite his American passport and major's rank, was, in fact, by birth, a French marquis. He'd emigrated to the United States, married an American, had worked for Corning Libby Ernst Glass. He was an engineer by background, and had got naturalized. But I shall never forget on one occasion when the French had got a new arrival from metropolitan France they wanted us to see and meet, whom we knew under the code name Duroc only. And Jerry Hill Pirlank and myself were invited to dinner at a little restaurant somewhere along the coast to meet Duroc. And to my surprise, as soon as Jerry Pirlank's eyes lighted on Duroc, he advanced on him and embraced him warmly. And he said, Guillain, je crois que nous étions dans la même équipe des Camelots du Roi, au 16e arrondissement. In his youth, they'd both been militant royalists. Rather unusual to find an American major. Anyhow, he was a splendid chap. And in general, our relations with OSS over the south of France were really admirable. And in great contrast, I think, to what happened in Italy, where OSS got themselves into very early trouble through using various members of the Sicilian mafia after the landing in Sicily, and with the effect that SOE really had to shoulder the burden and do all the work in northern Italy because of it subsequently, as OSS weren't regarded as reliable. But by the time of the landings in Normandy in June 44, we were able immediately to set up what was called the Special Projects Operations Center, SPOC, a hutted camp on the edge of the town of Algiers, which became our home and operational headquarters from then until we went into France with Club des Pins serving as sort of rear base as far as I was concerned. And the conditions were very primitive there, but we very soon found ourselves working really almost on a 24-hour round-the-clock basis, and one didn't have one's communication problems were minimal there. But this worked pretty well. But Wiedmer really was by far the most key figure, as far as we were concerned, on the French side. And I'm now rather amused working with Arthur Funk, over his book, to see that a nice man called Jean Constant, who was given by General de Lattre, he'd been his military assistant, he was a colonel, lieutenant colonel, given by de Lattre to be, to the DGSS, to be head of the Service Action side. But Constant, who was alive and quite vocal and takes part in seminars and has written on the subject, clearly just thought that I had got far too much in my own hands, and indeed found it quite hard to carve out a job for himself because Wiedmer was so absolutely admirable at doing it. But I've had rather a laugh over this with Arthur Funk. Constant feels he imposed himself by making himself difficult over various things. I said this sounds a little bit like Walter Mitty and or like de Gaulle, but I think more like Walter Mitty than the alternative. At any rate, he was in fact a perfectly nice man who hadn't really got very much of a job because he should have been liaising with the head of Massingham, John Anstey, and his OSS opposite number, a chap called Colonel Davis. But they didn't really want to deal with Constant very much. I don't think either of them spoke very much French. And so they vastly preferred to shove things down, to be dealt with by me, and I dealt with Wiedmer. So poor Constant waved about, regarding himself as rather too senior to deal with me, and cold-shouldered by the others. However, things gradually sorted themselves out. One little thing I intended before I forget it, that doesn't really belong to this period, belongs to the earlier period, I should have mentioned that that when Paul Colonna d'Istria came out from Corsica, when I brought him out in the summer of 43, he was given the VSO, and George VI, who was visiting North Africa at the time, and who had taken to coming down to bathe in the afternoons at the Club des Pins, a nice secluded point, decorated him in person. They didn't normally decorate foreigners, foreign recipients. But the King's visit to the Club des Pins gave rise to a situation of near farce. The first time he came, we hadn't been told he was coming on security grounds. And he was held up by Spanish Republican guards at the gate who telephoned through and said there was a Colonel Lyon waiting, coming to bathe. And nobody, the duty officer, hadn't heard of Colonel Lyon. So King George VI was kept under surveillance by Spanish Republican guards until this got sorted out. It took quite a while. However, he bore no ill will from it. And I told the Queen Mother about it course of this last summer, and she laughed a good deal about it, and sent me a book which recorded the exact comparable troubles that arose in Morocco through the extreme security surrounding his flight to the Mediterranean on that occasion and his flight back, so that no one really knew what was happening, and arrangements, they never could time anything properly. And he turned up vastly before he was expecting one occasion, but I'm sure it obviously made good telling in the royal family when he got back. But it was just thought of the Club des Pins that put this back in my mind. Paul Colonna, whom we knew as Cesari, went back into Corsica, and he'd had his horoscope told once again, and his expert said, I see you surrounded by your enemies, and I see you will emerge from it. Well, the poor fellow went back into France, into Corsica, with this prediction, and not long afterwards was caught in an area where the Italians were combing through the Maquis, and he was really in great danger of capture, and he went and did exactly what Ulysses did in the cave of Polyphemus. He lay down in the middle of a herd of goats, probably goats and sheep, because they're frequently run mixed, I think, in the Mediterranean, certainly in Greece. But these animals move on, and normally would have left him absolutely exposed, but by some extraordinary good fortune, they didn't. And he was never spotted by the Italians and got out, but in this curious way, his horoscope, 2 years running, predicted really quite accurately circumstances that became operational reality. I may say that having armed 12,000 Corsicans, the Italian armistice created quite a problem, because there was going to be no major Allied landing in Corsica, and the only Allied troops sent over in the first wave was a company of the French Battalion de Choc, who were put on the Casabianca, which couldn't submerge with that number of people on board, so she went across on the surface to Ajaccio and landed them, and the conning tower of that submarine is a public monument in Ajaccio to this day. I've seen photographs of it. But, of course, we had quite a difficult diplomatic task in that the Corsicans had to be persuaded not to shoot up the Italians with the weapons that they'd got, but reserve them for the Germans, who were withdrawing from Sardinia through Corsica. Well, not an awful lot of Italians got killed, I think. And then came the problem afterwards of trying to recuperate the arms that had been distributed. And Corsica's a country with quite a violent tradition. And the authorities were very keen not to have 12,000 additional weapons scurrying around. Well, we were very successful in recovering things like Bren guns, and pretty successful in getting rifles back. But we had a very poor result with submachine guns, Stens, and a nil result with pistols. So that French authority since that day in Corsica has had to contend with the fact that there are really quite a lot of weapons culling around in that country as a result of SAE's efforts during the war. I'm sorry for that little parenthesis. I should have finished off Corsica before getting involved in Spock. Well, the big drama of the summer of 44, the first big drama was the situation that arose over the Vercors plateau, which is a detached bit of the Alps lying just south of Grenoble, like an enormous aircraft carrier moored between the Rhone Valley and the Alps proper. And the French resistance people in that area, who included quite a lot of officers from a very crack regiment of Chasseurs Alpins that had been based in Grenoble. Very, very good French troops, demobilized in the country, got involved in the Maquis activity, and thinking as regular soldiers, their thought was to get and hold a piece of territory that would become liberated territory at an appropriate stage. And this thinking crystallized into a plan to seize the Vercors plateau, which has got a very limited number of roads leading into it, and some of them coming up through tunnels and up very steep passes, which very easy to defend. And they sent out the mayor of a principal village in the middle of the Vercors plateau, Villard de Lans, a man called Chavon, or Clément, by submarine to North Africa to enlist some support for this plan. Well, one of the complications of working from North Africa was that we had imperfect physical control of means of access and communications with France, whereas from England, SOE and its sister services really had a monopoly of radio and all forms of transport. But in the Mediterranean, we thought we had a monopoly of radio. We probably did more or less. We and SIS's mission out there. One could never be quite sure the French hadn't got a set or two. And as far as transport was concerned, the French got no aircraft that we regarded as suitable for parachute supply. They weren't quite clear that some of their aircraft couldn't be used. And they had submarines that were perfectly capable of making landings on the coast of France. And they, in fact, on the intelligence side, ran a monthly operation to Cap Lardier, just south of Saint-Tropez, which functioned extremely well. And Chabon, in fact, came out on one of these submarine operations. It wasn't, therefore, until a bit later that I even heard he was in Algiers, and he'd seen all sorts of people by that time, including Soustelle and probably de Gaulle, and had got blessing on this general idea, he thought, for declaring the Vercors a piece of liberated territory and barring access to the Germans. And nobody had bothered to consult the Americans or ourselves as to whether we could supply a beleaguered piece of territory like this far up into France. And I did just manage to meet Chavon the day before he went back. And I really hadn't discovered at that stage how far the whole thing had gone on the French side. So, with the encouragement of General Cauchy, who'd been set up, been deputed, he was an Air Force general, who'd been told by de Gaulle to be the counterpart in Algiers of General Koenig, who was the nominal commander of all the Forces Françaises de l'Intérieur in London, alongside Eisenhower. Cauchy was supposed to do the same thing from Algiers. Cauchy never actually discovered what he was supposed to do. So he went off into France finally with the staff of running, I think, some hundreds, and then got involved in the business of integrating the Force Française de l'Intérieur into the French army, which was quite an important task in itself. But in an operational sense, he was never a force, because to start off with, his coordination with Koenig was, communications with Koenig and so on were slender, and he really in practice had to work through Spock to London. And I think Cochet had obviously given Chabon a good deal of the encouragement that he must have had. So at the time of the Normandy landing, the Vercors resistance people closed access into the plateau, hoisted the tricolour, and declared themselves a liberated zone. And we were faced with an appalling logistic problem, which fell upon us very largely through radio links that we'd established with the chief SOE French section, Buckmaster section, agent in southeastern France, Francis Kamertz, who had turned up himself in the Vercors at that period. Kamertz is a very interesting case. It's fully documented in Foot, so I won't spend a lot of time on it. He was a very remarkable fellow. One of the three senior French section officers in France, because he became a lieutenant colonel in the field, and the other two being George Starr down in Toulouse, and a chap called Richard Heslop in the Jura. But at a D-Day in Normandy, Francis Kamertz found himself appointed as deputy to Henri Zeller, at that time a colonel, who had belonged to the French Army Resistance Organization, the ORA, in France. And the two of them teamed up and worked well, but they were both confronted with this ghastly problem that they had got this big area to defend. They needed heavy weapons. They needed regular troops. And the whole plan had been conceived without any regard to the fundamental principle, graven on my mind ever since I was a kid by reading Seven Pillars of Wisdom, that irregular troops mustn't try and hold ground, and very silly for them to try and do so. But the thinking of regular officers was to hold ground, and the Chasseurs Alpins were splendid people. They knew about fighting in the Alps, and they wanted to hold ground. And the fact that they got very low caliber troops in the FFI, people who were with them for the most part, still didn't alter that fundamental attitude. And they had got the impression from Cochet and La Chabon that paratroop reinforcement might be expected within a comparatively short time. Well, of course, it was quite irresponsible of Cochet, if indeed it was he who gave that impression, to have done so, because at the time when he spoke, which must have been in May, there was no decision even to have a landing in the south of France. That wasn't taken formally till July. And the French disposed of no... I mean, though they were proved ultimately able to twist the arm of the Allies into having a landing in the south of France, they hadn't got either the aircraft or the landing craft or anything to put trench forces in themselves, without calling upon Eisenhower's or Maitland Wilson, as it became after he left for the Norman Theatre Command, the Supreme Command, resources. And consequently, we got these increasingly pathetic and desperate calls for heavy weapons, artillery, mortars, etc., etc., and parachute reinforcement. Well, We had very little we could do about this. We dropped in one American OG, operational group, they were called, and it was an SOE group of 30 men. We dropped in an engineer who prepared an airstrip up on top. But at a place called Dassieu, I played an important part in subsequent operations. But artillery was simply not to be had, though the Americans had been experimenting in the United States with dropping artillery by air. It had never been done operationally, nor was there the material available. But a chap called Jeff Jones, who is today president of the Veterans of OSS, came to OSS originally at that stage because of this problem. He had been involved in the airdropping trials of artillery, was sent off in haste to Algiers, where he arrived too late to have any effect on the Vercors thing, and became conducting and training officer with OSS there. But in due course, disaster overtook the Vercors. The Germans, having waited from D-Day, and I may say there still is a dispute as to whether and why the Vercors decided to go into action on Normandy D-Day. They claimed that they'd heard a code message that had been arranged with them to begin operations. That message was never sent, in fact. But Cochet had undoubtedly given them the impression that they would enter into action on le jour J, on D-Day. Well, he never made it clear he was talking about D-Day in the south, still uncertain, or D-Day in the north. So, anyhow, one way or another, they started full-scale operations, came out of the woods and manned the passes and started attacking the Germans. Absolutely at D-Day, and managed to hold the Germans at least partially at bay for about 6 weeks. And on the 14th of July, Bastille Day, they had a splendid parade up on top of the mountain, and it was the one bit, it was exactly what, from a political point of view, the French wanted. De Gaulle, interestingly enough, wasn't very interested in the Vercors. He was, at the time, keenly interested in a much more ambitious plan of having a liberated zone in the Massif Central that he thought would be altogether nearer to Paris and to his political objectives than the Vercors. And there was tremendous toing and froing among the French as to whether they could summon up enough of their old aircraft to supply a redoubt in the Massif Central. But this idea was pushed also by the